welcome. I'm not sure exactly how to introduce myself. I teach at Or Chaim, and I've taught at various other places, and I don't know, probably nothing much to say. My name is Rabbi Eric Levy, and it's nice to meet all of you. And now let's learn a little bit of... you're very welcome. It was Rabbi Greenberg. One of Rabbi Greenberg's students found it.
Where was it?
Yeah, I think in the library.
It was here.
Somewhere.
It was in the library, right here.
Okay. Yeah. Take care.
Hi.
Okay. So, what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at metaphor in Tanakh. And the truth is, as I was sort of creating this year, I sort of got focused on, as you notice, there are handouts in front of you, it's very heavy on the text. So it became more of sort of, I had intended originally to just go through various types of metaphor in Tanakh and how they're used, and then to try to understand the difference between metaphor, simile, parable. But I got so sort of absorbed in the text themselves because they're so beautiful, it's become something of a regular Tanakh shiur in Mishlei, Kohelet, and a few others. So I hope you'll forgive me. I will be translating all texts for you, so you don't have to worry about translations. The problem is that online, for easy cutting and pasting, the only translation that exists online is really the King James, which is in the GP. Well, what's interesting is the JPS, the Jewish Publication Society, the old ones that they used to give out for bar mitzvah presents, is based on the King James, slightly modified.
They have a GPS.
And, yep. And... the translations really are really not satisfactory. They're very pretty, which the old King James has the advantage. They focus on staying within lyrical and poetic modes. The only problem is that it doesn't stay close to the translation of the text. So we have the new JPS, but the new JPS, since they want to make money on their text, they're not foolish enough to put them online. I decided not to bring any English translations, but I will be translating word for word. And the truth is that most of, I think as we see as we go along, that most of the texts are really not as difficult as they seem. So let's start off, and everything is up here as well as in front of you. There are some more handouts here. Does anybody need a handout?
Yeah.
Would you? There you go. Thank you. And there are some more handouts here as well.
Hello. Bunch,
right? Yeah, I think we should have plenty. Over there, there are handouts. I have another set of handouts, but it's so heavy in text, I don't want to scare you right away, so I'll scare you with the last 10 minutes of the shiur. I'll just work on my... I left this up there just for people who like to look up rather than look down, but I'll work on my side as well. This is a perek bet of Yeshayahu, and I have to tell you that when I learned this the first time, and I didn't learn it really, when I was just reading through Yeshayahu, I have major, major problems with not only understanding how to grapple with the issues that Yeshayahu is bringing up, but as a teacher, how do I teach these issues, especially in a mixed class or to a class of girls? And let me read through the text so you'll see what I mean. And then I'll make it more sort of interactive. I'll ask you how you feel that you see the text, or I know there are teachers among us. I would ask the teachers how they have taught the text. So let's read it through. Vishach gavuta adam vishafel ruman hashim v'nisgav Hashem levado b'yom ahu. So the reason why I cited that text from Isaiah 2, from Yeshayahu 2, is because there's a long prophecy that Yeshayahu begins in the middle of Perek Bet. And the reason why it's in the middle of Perek Bet, of course, is because the Christian archbishop, his name was Stephen Langton, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, he's the one who broke up the books into chapters. When you say, go to Genesis 4, verse 2, that's not our breakdown, that's the Christian breakdown, and it was done for reasons which I better not get into, or we'll get sidetracked. Very often, he was a great scholar, Stephen Langton. He worked on the Magna Carta. He was a chacham. He really was. However, what one finds is the more difficult the biblical texts become, the more mistakes he makes, because he really wasn't sure what he was doing. Plus, he came at it through his prism, which was a Christian prism, and therefore he saw the text in a certain way. I always say the reason, if you notice, that chapter 2 of the Bible, of Genesis, starts with Bayom HaShvi'i, Bayechu HaShemayim Va'aretz. So you should be saying to yourself, well, why not put that, you have 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, go all the way to 7 days in chapter 1. Why would you want to start chapter 2 with Shabbat? I don't know, but I'm guessing it's because their Shabbat is not the seventh day. So it seems possible that by interrupting the flow of the days of creation, 1 to 6 in chapter 1, and then the Shabbat in chapter 2, and then the rest of the second creation story with the rib and the whole thing, my feeling is that's because he needed to create a division between the 6 days and 7 days. I don't know that for sure. He didn't leave us any notes. But he makes mistakes, and some of those mistakes are based on the intentional mistakes of his worldview. You see, I told you I'd get distracted with this. So here he starts in the middle of chapter 2. In the middle of chapter 2, he starts talking about the Milat Mancha, the word which guides all of the understanding of the text, is man thinks he's so high, I'm going to bring him down low. The word Gavhut and Nisa and Ram shows up maybe 20 times. And then the word Shach, to bring down, or Morid maybe, other words which to indicate to bring down are also repeated over and over. It's so overpowering, one can't miss the point. The question is, which king is he speaking to? That's the study in Yeshayahu, which I'm not going to go into. But the key word is gavhu, which means to be haughty or to raise on up. And with that, now we're ready to tackle the text, which shows up at the continuation of the prophecy in chapter 3, verse 16. Vayomer Hashem, Yan ki gavhu benot Zion, because the daughters of Zion became haughty. Vatelachna netuyot garon, and they walked around with their necks all, hard to say, maybe bare, not probably more like, you know, looking around. You know, they were very uppity. Sakrot enayim, lasot skira, is to look around from place to place. As instead of walking down like this, the image that we're given is that they're walking through the streets and they're quite comfortable. Their eyes are in the air. Maybe their noses are a little bit too high in the air. And their eyes are all over the place in what seems to be quite an unfeminine way of going about things. Haloch v'tatov telachna, they walk drumming around, which means with good solid footsteps rather than kind of a small shuffling one. Uvaraglehem ta'akasna, and they actually maybe make like symbols on their legs where they draw attention to themselves with their stepping. V'shipacha adonai kodkod b'nei Tzion, and God will either burn or tear the heads, the skulls, or the top of the heads of the daughters of Zion. Vashem pateni yareh, God will cause some kind of disaster or some kind of disease or some kind of burning to their heads. Vashipach Adonai sorry about that. Vayomahu, and that day, Yasir Adonai et tiferet akasim. I'm going to read through this quickly. Vahashivisim, Vahasaharonim, Aretivot, Asherot. This is like the 11 sons of Haman. You got to see how fast you can read this stuff. V'haralot v'aperim v'atzadov v'kishurim v'batei ha'nefesh v'alachashim v'tavot v'nizmei ha'af. Nizmei ha'af, we all know what that is. That's the jewelry of the nose. V'amachlatzot v'amatafot v'mitpachot v'acharitim v'gilyonim v'esdinim v'antipo v'aridim. All of these are accoutrements of a woman. Neck scarves, batei ha'nefesh, and various other flowing chains and chains around the head and all kinds of nice dress. God will remove all of these things. Vayatachat bosem makihiyah. It's very, very emphatic. Instead of bosem, instead of perfume, makihiyah. Mak is like dust and ashes. Vetachat chagora nikpa. And underneath a belt, apparently a fancy belt, nikpa, some kind of tornness. There's some kind of clothes that are torn. Vetachat maasem mikshe korcha, and baldness rather than maasem mikshe is probably braided hair, fancily braided hair. Instead of that, they'll have ripped out hair or baldness. Vetachat ptigil machgoret sak, and instead of some kind of fancy ptigil, some kind of fancy braiding of clothes, they'll be machgoret sak. They'll be wearing clothes of what's the word? Sackcloth. Right. That's very good. Ki tachat yofi. Ki is an interesting word. Ki is short for kviyah, which is burns. Ki kviyah tachat yofi. Instead of their beauty, they will be burns. Ve'achaziku sheba nashim b'yishachad. And seven women will try to attract themselves to try to get the attention of one man. Bayomahu le'mor lachmenu nochel v'simlatenu nilbash rak. Let us be your wives. Just take us in. We'll take care of the food as long as we have a name that we can call themselves. So where women were haughty and where they were raised up on high, they are now brought down to the low where they're back sort of understanding that what they really need is the name of a good man above them. So, ouch. You know, if you read this text... And again, if I'm reading it wrong, if I'm misunderstanding it, so please tell me, what is your feeling as I'm reading this text? What is the Navi trying to say in his time? And I should preface, by the way, that in chapter 5, the Navi will go through all kinds of social mores. Hoy anashim omrim al ara tova tov ra, those who lie. Hoy al mashkime boker yayin yalikem. Oy to those who wake up in the morning and drink and go to the last thing they do in the evening is drink. Hoy lebone bayit. Oy to those who build these super big houses until one house is right next to another house and there's no room for the poor to have any land whatsoever. So there's a series of social mores that Yeshayahu in chapter 5, shortly after this, is complaining about and says that they will be the downfall of Israel. So how do you read this text if you read this text? Or have you ever read this text and said, what am I going to do with it? Right. So you've just ruined my whole shiur. The whole thing's over. I'm just kidding.
Right?
I'm just kidding. No, but you're what you're saying is that the
something that we can, I mean, this is something that we can relate to on a human level
what's the metaphor though? What are we? So we're not talking about fancy clothes. We're not talking about perfume, and we're not talking about women who look around quite confident of themselves. And where do we want those women? We want those women in the house, even if there's seven of them in one house, to know their place. So where do you see the reference behind the metaphor? What is the passage trying to say? I agree, and as I said, that kind of ruins the shiur. And what I'll do step by step is show perhaps what the metaphor is. I have a different idea of what this metaphor is, and I'll try to prove it. But I don't know, does anybody ever read this and say, ooh, I'm very uncomfortable with this? Or everybody say, well, it's true that now we have feminism, but back in the day, women really were supposed to be. I mean, all you have to do is look at Arab society, and it's not like in nations that are quite modern in most respects, in Saudi Arabia, okay, Iran is one thing, but in Saudi Arabia, a woman goes out without her hair covered. There was just a case about two people, a man and a woman, who were drinking at a Starbucks, I think it was, and now they're thrown in jail, and there was somebody else who was dancing because the electricity went off, so they had a day off of work, so they went they were doing a little fake dancing, and then they got thrown into jail. So it's not like that kind of society doesn't exist. And I have to say, when I read it first, I was thinking, oh my goodness, I can't teach this. If I was living in Yeshayahu's time where feminism was not an issue and women knew their place, then I could teach it. But today I'm going to skip over this section because it'll anger people. There may have been, but the question is Yeshayahu really getting his ardor up over whether women are dressing with fancy things on themselves? Right, but ultimately, well, it's true, but then you're also saying something interesting, which is, even though I believe this is a metaphor, or maybe referring to the way we deal with the nations and how we deal with the nations, it's based on, in order to understand that, it's based on a real reality, which is that women need to know their places. If they go walking out in the streets, they are doing the wrong thing. That's still challenging. That's right. But it's not. But it's the women who are being.
And to put more into their clothing and in their appearance than men. So I think that's the reality of society.
In ancient times, women were not supposed to dress like a woman. One example I thought was very interesting, that in Egypt they've got all the paintings on the walls, and the men are darker than women. The women don't know what's on.
Although they were dressed very nicely in Egypt. there was definitely a cult of body in Egypt. I have Devorah of there are cases that where we have cases where actually in Judaism we are sort of advanced. We had Devorah as a ruler of the people. One gets the feeling that however you might feel about Michal, David's either first or second wife, depending on how you look at how things turn out, there's a certain forcefulness of woman that does exist in Tanakh. And this just seems to beat them down for the littlest reason. Even if we take the metaphoric idea, which eases the problem, I have to say, I didn't see the metaphoric idea. I saw him talking about a whole bunch of social mores, and this is anti-feminism, and I'm going to skip this when I teach it to my girls' 12th grade class because I'm going to get killed on. You could. You could.
They behaved like, and if they didn't observe the mores of their society at their time,
could. It's possible. It's absolutely possible to interpret this literally, in which case, you know, again, maybe it's my perspective as modern Orthodox. Perhaps if I was Haredi and the women really were much, you know, in a certain place and there was no dating and the women were really not, although I think even in the Haredi world, I think there are women who dress up nicely and walk on the streets. The question is, how do I take a lesson from this? So I'm going to...
How can you define what you mean? If you want to define metaphor...
I'm going to. I'm going to spend a lot of time defining metaphor. Yes, I agree. So I really, the truth is, you sort of jumped into it, and beautifully, the idea that this may be a metaphor. In order to do that, we need to define metaphor, which is the point of the class. I wanted to point out that there's nothing in this text that you can't, the question is, how do you recognize, the question I get that I'm going to spend time teaching is, how does one recognize metaphor? Because when you read these words simply, there's not an indication of other, at least at a first glance. And it's a slightly polemic view, because if you notice, I've skipped a pasuk or two at the end, which I think is important to clarify that it is a metaphor. But if I'm just reading these psukim, I think if you give this to most people and say, read this in Hebrew and English, most people will not be thinking metaphor. Now, if they're in a class where the title of the class is on the use of metaphor in Tanakh, they might be keyed off a little bit. But I think if you ask your average person to read this, and what does it mean? Most people, especially girls in modern Orthodox high schools at 12th grade, will be saying, what is up with Yeshayahu? Maybe he should chill out and worry about some more serious things than whether women are walking around with perfume and with nice neck scarves. Yeah, just one more question. I want to move on, but not because I want to suppress ideas, but because we have so little time and so much to do. Yeah, go ahead.
If sublimated sexuality is angry because he wants women, he can't have them, and so because he can't reach out and grab them, he wants to destroy.
Look, I want you to know something. I disagree with that completely, and yet I can completely see where that's a response that somebody needs to take to the text. Here's a guy who's talking about big things, about nations and countries and evils, and all of a sudden he has a riff about these women. So one would start to psychologize. Now, it happens to be Baruch Hashem, we know they had a wife. We meet her in the text, and they had four nice kids. They had Shar with weird names. They have Shar Yashuv, they have Pele Yoetz Avia Azer, they had Emmanuel. His wife had Emmanuel, not a virgin. That's where the Christians get their whole Jesus thing from, but it was wife who had Emmanuel. And there's also Maher Shalal Chashbaz. Really strange names, which, by the way, are completely metaphoric in their response. It's a book of metaphors. But I agree with you in the sense, even though I disagree with your interpretation, because possibly because I can't see my prophet behaving that way, and yet you're responding to a serious problem. What's up with Yeshayahu? And you have to start searching for things. And the way to resolve that issue is to demonstrate that these are metaphors. And the only way to do that is to probably show you some either hotter passages in Tanakh. So if anybody's under 18 in the room, we may want to... I feel like I'm doing like those TV shows, where like news shows. We're about to show you certain pictures. Is anybody under 18? The parents may want to take their kids out. So let's go to the next page. And let's go to that woman of Proverbs. Of course, I'm underlining the word that because I'm... As you might know where that's a reference from, why I'm underlining the word that. That's sort of a Clinton reference, I hate to say. You know, that kind of that woman. So I have a little bit of that. The sense of evil, the sense of nasty, the sense of seduction, it's not my fault, it's somebody else's fault. And that's partially what we're dealing with here. And I'll read through the text, and it's really quite beautiful. I hope you have enough time for all the text, because this is stuff in Mishlei that people usually... I mean, Mishlei becomes a little bit like a Confucius cookies, you know, little bites and pieces. But actually, in the beginning of Sefer Mishlei, there are these long passages which are very much related to each other. So let's read through it. Nitzor v'ni mitzvat avicha, guard, nitzor from the word nitzor, l'shon chamera, u'svatah nidavira, which means guard these mitzvot. Al titosh torat imecha, do not leave off the instruction of your mother. Koshreim al libecha tamid, tie them onto your heart always. Of course, we're deep in metaphor because nobody can actually tie onto their hearts. Ondeim al gargrotecha, put them on your neck, that is, wear them maybe like a chain. Behitalcha tancha otach, and let them guide you as you're walking around. Bishochbacha tishmor alecha, as you sleep, they will guard you. That is, as you go to bed, these things will protect you. Now, we don't know what these things are yet. We'll get to what these things are in a second. And when you wake up, it will be your, that is the Torah that I'm teaching you, will be on your tongue, and it will protect you from all these evils. Kiner mitzvah, you probably recognize this, of course. Kiner mitzvah, the Torah or, v'derech chayim tochat musar, and the way of life is to be instructed against evil, essentially. I'm paraphrasing a bit. Let's take a look and see what the instruction is. The most important thing that you could possibly do, kiner mitzvah and Torah or, let's take a look. L'shmorcha me'eshet ra, to guard you from the evil woman. Michalkat l'shon nachriya, from the slipperiness, word chalak, from the slipperiness of the tongue of the foreign woman. Not foreign as in not Jewish, but as the one you're not supposed to be with. Al tachmod yafya b'levavcha, do not covet her beauty in your heart. Al tikacha b'afafeh, and don't get taken in by her eyelashes. Nice, right? It's nice. No, don't, the whole eye flirty thing. Ki ba'adi shazonad kikar lechem. It's a nice sentence. A person, for the sake of a, not a prostitute. That's not really what zonad means. It means a loose woman. Ad kikar lechem. A person will spell his, he'll spend his last dollar. That's what it means. Ad kikar lechem means he's willing to go down to his last loaf of bread just so he can attract and persuade or get to this girl that he's so attracted to. Ve'eshet ish nofet yikara tatsur. And the married woman, she stalks or captures in a negative sense the heart or the soul of a very special soul. So Isha Zara actually is somebody else's wife. This seems to be a passage about adultery. And now it gives you some amazing metaphors to support the idea that one should not commit adultery. Hayichate ish b'cheiko uvgadav lo tzesarafna. Does everybody see where we are? Let me highlight it. It's a beautiful metaphor. Hayichate ish b'cheiko uvgadav lo tzesarafna. Could a person hold fire in their chest without getting burnt? I think, what's the English expression for that? It's an English expression like that, like don't, like, too hot, get out of the kitchen, something like that. What's that? You get out of the kitchen, right? There's all kinds of things. But it means you can't play, play with fire. Are you playing with matches. Imi halech ish al chalim raglav lo tikavena, there's that word to burn again. Can a person really walk in coals without being burned? Kain habal esh re'eu lo yinakeh kol anogei abad. Anybody who sleeps with his friend's wife or somebody else's wife, re'eu in tzedakah does not necessarily mean friend, it can mean any other. Lo yinakeh kol anogei abad. There's no way he'll ever be clean from this sin. It's an unforgivable sin. Why? It says, it's beautiful stuff. Lo yavuz l'ganav ki yignov l'malei nefesh yirav. Nobody gets upset at a... That is, ultimately, nobody feels terrible against the thief who steals when we know he's hungry. There's a thief who's hungry and he steals. He gets himself to all kinds of trouble, but ultimately people forgive them in their hearts because they know that there is a motive behind it. The guy stole money from you because he needs to pay for a sandwich. That's a nice idea. He's going to wind up losing everything. Ultimately, this guy can understand his motivation, and yet he loses everything. But no, if ish chaser leiv mashchit nafsho hu yaseni, he destroys his soul. Nagav kalon yimsa, he finds nothing but the opposite of kavod is kalon. So the opposite of honor is not exactly dishonor. I'm not sure how you would say it. What's a good word for that? Shame, degradation is a good word. His shame will never be clean. He's talking about the husband who was cheated on. Because the guy will never forgive him. He will take no payoff for this. And he will never, ever, ever take a bribe to forgive somebody for sleeping with his wife. It's great advice, by the way. And a guy who knew women better than anybody else was, of course, Shlomo HaMelech. This seems to be a good piece of advice. Preparation in this perek, a perek shishi, I'm going to give you some of the most important Torah in your life. Don't commit adultery. And he wraps it in all kinds of beautiful texts to really appreciate that's important. Now, it's possible that's what Sefer Mishlei is about. This perek of Sefer Mishlei. Because that's one of the Ten Commandments. It's certainly something that people stumble upon. So let's focus. And Shlomo was in a particularly skilled area to know how to teach people to stay away from physical pleasures. So maybe that's what he wants to accomplish. The only problem is that woman of Proverbs does not show up in Perek Shishi. She shows up in Perek Sheni, Perek Hamishi, Perek Shishi, Perek Shvii, and Perek Shmini. Over and over again. Let me take you to the next page and you'll see what I mean. This is chapter 5. It's over and over and over again. Like, I get the point. B'ni l'chokhmati akshiva. Listen to my wisdom. L'tvunati hatos necha. Tilt your ear to my... to my bina, to my understanding. Lishmor mizimo, to watch after plants, which means to, you know, mizima is to calculate carefully, which means make your plans and stick to them. That's what lishmor mizimo is. V'dat svatecha yinsaru, and the knowledge your lips shall guard. Ki nofet titofna siftei zara, because the lips of this foreign woman, they drip with honey. Nofet titofna. The chalak mishemen chika. There's that word chalak. They're smooth like oil. Her mouth, or the top of her mouth, is smooth like oil. It's talking about seduction here, of course. And it's also talking about makeup. It's a nice thing about metaphor. Metaphorically, I could use the idea of her tongue being slippery, and I can mean not only the moistness and the sexuality of that term, but also the fact that she lies. That seduction is a lie. Let me continue on. V'acharitam mara kala ana, and her end will be as bitter as a wormwood. Chada kecherev piot, her end will be as sharp as a sword, which means maybe that she'll wind up dying by the sword, something like that. Ragleha yordot mavet, her legs drip death. Sheol tzadeh yitzmochu, her steps support hell itself, or the grave. Oruch chayim pentfales, difficult passage, but I'll try to translate it this way. The way of life she never finds out. Nao maglotel lo deda, and she never knows which way to go, which means she's going nowhere. Why would you say that? Why would you say that? Because there's less information that allows you more to interpret. Which means in the previous chapter, we had all that stuff. It really seems to be talking about a woman. But here, where it's vaguer, maybe I'm talking about a avodah zara. That's possible. I want to show you something else very interesting. Let me highlight some words that you may find interesting here. Where am I?
Go ahead.
Yeah, great. I agree. There's nothing wrong. There would be nothing unkodesh if Mishlei was teaching you al tinaf. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. The question is that what it's really trying to accomplish? Again, because our course is called on the use of metaphor, so we're looking for the... It's kind of like when you ask somebody, how much do you think that costed? So you know the person is paid more, so you overguess. Like, you thought the person would pay $2. You say, how much do you think this cost me? So then the person says, $800 million, you know, because you're sort of looking for the exaggeration. So you're all looking for the metaphor now, and I agree with you, there's less information. It may be Zara is talking about Avodah Zara, but ultimately these are very, her legs drip with death. I mean, there's unbelievable things. And before I take the question, I will. Here's something which may clue you in to not only the Kedusha of this book, but the Kedusha to another book. Does anybody know where, Mayafu, look at what's in a Mizgeret. From Shir HaShir. I agree completely. And again, you're all ruining my shir by seeing exactly where I go to. So the shir will simply then be a series of cases where I show examples of that. But what I'll do is I'll show more obvious examples of that. But you're right, although there would be nothing unkodesh, just a second, there would be nothing unkodesh if the book was just about lo tinah. But what's really interesting, what I wanted to point out here, and hold on, Ellen, I'm going to take another question first, is this is positive. That is whether you think, you could still say Shir HaShirim is not about God. And there are many people who say that. It's just a love story. But there's no question that the love story written in the biblical hand is a positive thing. Your lips are sweet, like they drip with honey. There is honey and milk under your tongue. And the smell of your clothes is like the cedar tree smell. Here what we have is that Nofet Titofna is being used positively over here in Shir HaShirim and incredibly negatively here in Mishlei, which creates a tension which sort of forces you to look at the metaphoric meaning. Because if Nofet Titofna has one meaning, and it's in the time of Shlomo, that is, if I say the guy's a monster, if I say that about a musician, actually means he's very good. And if I say something is monstrous, it can be very bad. So it is possible for something to have opposite meanings. But more likely, if Nofet Titofna has a specific literal meaning, then either use it to describe the ultimate good of Shir HaShirim, of the beauty of the woman who you love, or use it to describe the danger and bitterness of the woman that you will get seduced by. But to use both immediately, to my mind, suggests that there's something else going on, suggests a metaphoric meaning. And at a simple level, it's just kind of very interesting to see that the very same phrase, which we assume was written by the very same person, is being used in two very separate ways, which gives you a little bit of idea of Shlomo's Chachma. The one argument, and again, I'll get to it in a second. The one argument that you made, of course, have to be careful with, is circular. I know the books have to have something holy behind them. Why do I know that? Because they're in the books of Tanakh. Why are they in the books of Tanakh? Because there's something holy in them. You see, it's a circular logic based on our faith. And I believe it too, but you have to be careful with that kind of circular logic.
But the literal meaning is relevant, but the literal meaning is inappropriate.
So that's
the
question.
The
by Shira Shirim, I'm going to tell you that by Shira Shirim, our school would disagree with you. Right? Our school does not allow any literal meaning. And if we find that this is a metaphor, I'm sure there are plenty of people that say that there is no literal meaning here. The question is, can I believe that there is a metaphoric meaning and a literal meaning? And obviously the answer is to be yes, because that's where I'm really driving for. But I want to be able to show it and demonstrate it as we go on. Yes?
Well, I just want to comment about the two different Tanakhim here, and 6 and 5. It seems to me that there's a different emphasis on who the person is that we're talking about in each. And that in the 6 characters, there's a lot of description of the relationship. There's a lot of discussion about what happens to the man who presumably is like the advice being given to him to stay away.
Right.
And then in the 5th paragraph, it's really just pretty much describing this woman, this femme fatale, basically, right? And I think that for me, I could be very comfortable with the reading of the 6th paragraph just really being advice to a man about what to do, and this sort of this description of what happens in relationships.
Right.
But the emphasis in 5
yeah.
on this woman and describing her in such extreme terms and just about her makes me think that it's not about the man. It's not about these relationships. It's not really about some sort. It's not shop, because we're not talking. If we're talking to you, we should be talking to you about what happens to you, not just let's describe this sort of image of a woman.
I think,
in terms of advice, if you're going to give advice, it's very effective to say
involve you in
to
the
you,
situation rather than just
like,
describing
let's
her.
Describe this thing better.
It's possible. I could see the argument the other way, though. I mean, it's possible. It's certainly theoretical. It's possible that I'm saying, listen, here, let me hold up a picture of you. Get it? You know, it's possible to give advice that way, although I agree. Again, I'm not sure. I think if you ask your average person, without being in this kind of setting, just as a test, like an unscientific survey, go over to a few people, show them the passage in Hebrew and in English, just as passion, and say, what is Shlomo talking about? And I'm curious how many people will say it must be a metaphor about something. I suspect that most people will say Shlomo is using his good knowledge of 1,000 women to teach us who to stay away from, I think. I could be wrong, but I think. I'm sorry, excuse me. Yes?
Woman and you should be avoiding her at all costs, especially when you've got this example you're pointing out. Many of these descriptions are actually things you think of as being positive, right? You're not thinking,
right.
What's negative about that? What's negative about, you know, the lips or whatever having the oil on them?
And therefore, what?
So that's not very good advice to someone. Say avoid this because you're so attractive.
Unless you say that the advice is, if you see a girl wearing lipstick, run the other way. I mean, maybe that's what it's trying to say, which may be what Yeshayahu was trying to say if he was speaking about specific women.
Right.
In which case, we have a hard time understanding what the
positive terms. I'm saying
right.
That is very difficult.
Right, you're right. You're right. I'm going to move on just because we have a lot less time than I'd like to have. This is obviously I packed too much information in. I'm going to skim through some of this. Here we go. She's back in chapter 7. And she's got this nice speech, which I'll read to you. Over b'shuk etzel pinah. I'll start from the beginning. Somebody who goes to the shuk by the corner. V'derech beitah yitzad. V'neshef be'erev yom b'isham b'layla v'afilah. Whether you go in the morning, whether you go in the night. V'hine isha l'krato. And there's a woman who comes out to greet him as he walks through the shuk. Sheet zonah. She's dressed up as a prostitute. Not a prostitute, but as a loose woman. Ooh, Nitzurat Lev, with an entrapping heart, which means she has a certain aspect to the way she comes out of the house. Homiyavihi Soraret, with a great muddle and to-do, and she is a Soraret that is noise and leading one astray, like Ben Sorer Moret. Bebeita lo yishkenu ragleha. She never stays in her own house. Pam b'chutz, pam rechovot. Once she's outside, once she's in the rechovot. By the way, the word rechovot, I want you to notice two words here. Rechovot does not mean street. It means town square in Biblical Hebrew. From the word rachav, wide. And notice this word homiyah, which is strange, with a great noise. Because what is she doing? She's yelling? It's not clear. Let me read on. Ve'etel kol pina terov. She terov it means one lays in wait against every corner. Ve'hafzika bov nashkalo. And she, it's quite the image. She grabs onto him as she walks by and gives him a kiss. He'eza paneho. And she lifts up her face and she says to him like this. And what she says is unbelievable. Zimchei shlamim alai. I've got all kinds of meat in my house. Hayom shilamti nedarai. I've paid off my neder, so I've got everything cooked up, nice, ready to go. Alkei datzati the kritelchon. That's why I've come out to greet you. L'shacher panecha v'emtzecha. I was looking for your face, and I found you. Marvadim ravadati arsi. I have made up my bed in a very special way. Chatuvot etun mitzrayim. I've sprinkled some kind of maybe leaves or some kind of perfume from Mitzrayim. Nafti mishkabi, my bed, from the word nofet titofna, is like it's dripping with good smells. Mor ohalim v'kinamon. Ohalim are a type of spice. Mor is myrrh and kinamon is cinnamon, of course. Lecha nirved dodim ad haboker. Let us drink down dodim ad boker. Rav Sadia Gaon says dodim actually is saliva. Others say it's simply a metaphoric idea of love from the word dodeh, but either way, it's quite, we're a little bit out there. Nit al sab ahavim, let us sleep together in love. Ki ein ha'ish beveito, because my husband's away. Halach v'derech mirachok, and he's really, don't have to worry about him coming back, because he's actually on a long business trip. Tzroa kesev l'kach v'yodo, how do I know that? Because he took a whole cash with him. L'yoma kesa yavo beito. He won't come back until the 15th of the month. The kesa, the kesa, the yom chagenu means the new moon, the full moon. Kitatu berov l'chan. He is bent with all of her speaking. B'chelek svatel tadichenu. She has moved him with the slipperiness of her lips. Holecha charecha pitom. So he goes after her suddenly. Kishor al tevach yavo. He goes like a cow to the slaughter. Until he gets hit with the spears. And then let's go down to the next paragraph. Do not go after her ways, etc., etc. This is very provocative, to say the least. And there's no, to my mind, there's no sense of metaphor here whatsoever. When one reads this, this is a classic example of do not get seduced. And it's all the classic lines. My husband's away, everything's ready for you, plenty of money and meat in the house. It might as well be a handbook on how to commit adultery rather than a guard book on how to avoid adultery. Right? I mean, it's really very provocative. And so I want you to focus on the words homiyah and rechovot, and I'll tell you why. We'll go to the next page, and I'll show you the secret to Mishle. Of course, who do I have up there on the left-hand side? Does everybody recognize who that is?
I don't know.
That's a lady. You know who that is? Does anybody know the woman on the left?
Justice.
That's Lady Blind Justice. The Lady Blind Justice, who has three things. She is blind because she does not lo yisab panim. She does not honor people just because they are rich or poor. She has mishkal on one hand to say she's going to weight everybody equally, and she has a sword in the other hand, which means she'll beat out the justice that she wants. Lady Justice, what's called, it's a type of mashal, it's a type of metaphor called a personification, where I take an abstract idea and I create a person out of this abstract idea. This below it is the first parak of Mishle. And the reason why I ran it out of order was to show you that if you read this parak of Mishle first, all of the other prakim become clear. And it is impossible to confuse any of it. Let's read through the very first parak of Mishle. And I don't know how many people have read this text, because, I don't know, Mishle is not really the kind of book. It's a hard book to learn, I suppose, because it's poetic. And people just don't get to it. I'll show you how beautiful it is and how it's the mafteach to the rest of the first nine chapters of the book, because after that, the book changes into a different set of orders. Chochmot bachutz tarona. A woman named Chochmot. Do you see that name? That's her name. We know she's a woman. I'll show you. She's a woman. She's being described as going out, doing things, calling, yelling. Why is she called Chochmot? So it's obvious. So you don't miss the muscle. You can't call her Chochma because that's the abstract idea. You can't call her Lily because that won't help you out with your metaphor. So you call her Chochmot to tell you that it's a personification of Chochma. Do you follow what I'm saying? Yes.
How much? It's a nice English.
Oh, good, good. So while we're doing the Hebrew and I'm explaining, you read along in English, okay? But quietly. Chochmot bachutz tarona. She goes outside. Chochmot goes outside. Barchovot titein kola. She goes to the rechovot. Do you recognize that word? Let me highlight it. Do you see those two words? Chovot and homiyot, the same ones that were used by her in case of adultery. She goes out into the town square to raise her voice. Barosh homiyot tikra. Now here the word homiyah makes a lot of sense. With one woman, what was she yelling about? Homiyah means a hullabaloo. What it's saying is that over the hullabaloo of the town square, the cordo, the buying this, the get your cow out of the way, get my lambs out of the way, etc., she makes sure that her voice is heard over all that noise. That's what Mishlei is saying. Bepitrei Sharim, she goes to the Petach Sharim, which is the same place we had our adulteress from later on. Be'ir Amareha Tomer, and she says what she's going to say, and now she's speaking. Ad matai ta'im te'ahavu peti, until you fools, when will you love your foolishness? V'leitzim latzon chamdu lahem, and you scoffers, will you enjoy your scoffing? Uksilim yisnu udat, and when will you fools hate knowledge? She's not teaching people about adultery or how to behave sexually in any way. She's discussing the issue of listening to the Torah. And there are those parallels in Mishnah. The Torah is equal to Dat, is equal to Chokmah. Tashuv l'tochachti, come to my teachings. I'm teaching you everything I know. Odia divrei itchem, I'm going to explain to you or let you know, for the word Dat, all of my teachings. Yan karati v'tamainu, but I have to warn you, I called to you and you refused. Nikteti yadi v'ein makshiv, I stretched my hand out to you and you would not listen to me. That's going to be her big thing, because people, the whole argument here is, if I never knew, ignorance is an excuse for the law. If I never knew about Chachma because I was too busy playing dice out in the Rechobah, what was I supposed to know? And what Mishlei is saying here is there's no such thing. Chachma made sure that she could be heard to everybody. And if you don't listen, that's because you refuse to listen, not because you didn't hear me. Let me continue on. Yan vatifru kol atzati v'tochachti lo avitem. You refused all my advice. I'm going through it quickly. Gamani be'eichem eschak. I will laugh at your fear. Elag, and I will mock bevo pachchem. When your punishment comes, your fear comes, I will mock. When it comes like destruction, your fear, and your fear comes like a storm. And look at her make. Just, I want you to read the next line that I've highlighted. Look how funny she is. Most people miss this initially. It's so beautiful. It's such a beautiful personification. Do you see how to read this? Azikra unnini. Velo anes. So they'll call to me and I won't answer. Yishachrunini. You like that?
I like that one.
Isn't that sweet? She's a real woman here. And she's mocking them. You could feel the mockery. And they won't be able to find me. Taha ki sanu dat yirat Hashem lo bachar. And here is, of course, the famous comparison between dat and yirat Hashem. Knowledge coming from fear of God. The Torah being Eitz Chaim Hila Machazikim Ba. By the way, Mishlei is talking about Chokhmah, not about the Torah. But the assumption is that all Chokhmah comes from the Torah. If you start up here, you recognize that this woman is not real. There's no question that we're not questioning the reality of this woman. We know she's a personification. She's not. What she is Chokhmah coming out as a woman and saying, you should have listened to me when I spoke. Therefore, when I read the other passages in chapter 2, in chapter 4, 5, in chapter 6, in chapter 7, then you know that the woman that you're speaking of there is also not real. That is, this is the key to, we're not talking about metaphor. I'm sorry, that we're not talking about a real event, we're talking about a metaphoric personification. Therefore, if Chokhmot is a personification of wisdom, then she's the good woman, then who is the personification of the, that is, who is the bad woman personifying? What is the personification? It's mathematical. What would you say? Who is the Isha Zara personifying? Anti-wisdom. Exactly right, just mathematically. If you don't listen, and now all of those passages make sense. Why does it say, oh, you have to listen to my mitzvah, ner mitzvah and Torah or, now let me talk about adultery. Okay, that's a little limited. I said adultery is important, but you said you were going to teach me all of mitzvah and Torah or. But that's because that adultery is nearly the idea, please, that idea of adultery, the idea of cheating on your lover, it's not cheating that goes into the issue of avodah zarah or minut or apikorsis. It's much broader ideas. It sure includes adultery, But it's much greater than that. It comes to the core of religion. Do you see what I'm saying? And then if you have chapter one, then the rest of the chapters become clear and they cannot be mistaken at all. Now, my only question for you is it only, what would you say? Is Mishlei then, now that I've proven, based on our Chochmah woman, that adultery is simply a metaphor to cheating on God, so to speak, in one way or the other, is it no longer a text about adultery and about seduction and about sexual desires? What would you say? Why would you say it's both? If I just proved to you that the inner core meaning is about our relationship with God, then why would you say that it's also about adultery? What's that? Let me try a metaphor. I agree with you 100%. But were they willing to take that chance by also offering up
that's the way they thought, that's the way they expressed it.
And they wanted to teach both lessons, both the metaphoric one as well as...
Just the metaphoric.
Okay, so now we have an argument.
Yeah,
good. Now we're getting some arguments. All of you were sounding all right before, but now we have somebody saying, no, it's only about what the metaphor means, not the metaphor as a literal text. And other people say, no, it's about the literal text. It's about both the literal... We know for sure it's about the deeper hidden meaning because I was able to prove that with Chochmah. The question is, the literal meaning is also a book about don't commit adultery. One person, I think not only one person, is saying, no, book is Kodesh, not about adultery. I'm not going to be talking about some woman in nearly X-rated terms in the middle of my book of Mishlei. And the fact that we don't understand this because we don't have the sophistication that they did. Another person is saying, no. Why shouldn't the text have both levels of meaning? And I'm not talking about reader-centric text here. That's always a day of danger. I don't care what the author meant, it's really whatever I want to make of it. Maybe that's true, although I don't agree with it, but my question is not that. My question is, what did the author want to convey to us?
That part doesn't make any sense unless the literal meaning has some sense to begin with. Unless there's a danger of a woman,
that's
can't convey the danger of using
I agree.
Therefore, there has to be something said.
You say exactly what Rashi is going to say to me, which I'm going to get to in a second, but you still haven't answered the question. I'll give you an example. I fell into her eyes like a man drowning. Not like, because as soon as I use the word like, that's no good, because now it's a simile. Let me try again. I was lost in her eyes, pools of impossibly infinite depth. So, do I mean that I'm actually drowning in a pool, or is I'm just trying to convey certain... I'm trying to say she got really nice blue eyes.
The concept of drowning has to be understood, or you will understand.
True, I agree, but does it have to be meant? Am I really drowning? And by the way, you may...
It doesn't have to be literal, but the concept of drowning has to be understood as a reality as well.
Therefore,
the concept of a woman
who
can seduce you and something therefore
has to be understood, but is it core message?
I
agree with you, but I'm not sure it has to be a core message.
It may not be a message, but it has to be understood as a danger.
That I agree 100%. 100%. Yes, yes. We're not going to get to it because we're not a third of the way where we need to be, but I do want to jump ahead to this very powerful idea. And I learned this from my teacher, Mordechai Cohen, and you can learn it from Moshe Ibn Ezra, no relation to Avram Ibn Ezra. A metaphor is not simply A equals B. The Rambam feels that that's true. What do? I have an abstract concept, hard to get a handle on. So what I do is I give a metaphor, and the metaphor makes it easy to understand. How do I get back to the idea? I reverse the equation. But Moshe Ibn Ezra says something different. He's saying that what I do is I create a new reality. There's an idea of love, and there's an idea of drowning in a pool. And by connecting the two, I create something which is not existent in this world, and I'm able to describe an emotion which cannot be described. When I drown in the woman's eyes, there's the idea of I'm lost in the emotions, and there's the idea of the fact that she has beautiful eyes, but all of a sudden I create this power, By using metaphor and by combining the world of the metaphor and the reference, the mashal and the mishal, I'm able to not only describe the emotion of being lost in love, but to give it a power and meaning which is impossible to do by either thinking of just the metaphor or the reference by itself. I create a new reality which was not part of this world. I don't know if I'm really directing my answer directly at your, or my comment directly at what you had to say, but I agree with you that emotion of drowning, I could not. And the truth is, you could argue, well, I could just say it. A poet needs to say it fast. If I was a literalist, I would say, I felt really, really emotional and lost in this relationship. Let me explain why. I woke up one day, and then, you know, it's forever. So in one word, I'm drowning in the pools of her eyes, so all of a sudden I capture it. So you could just say it's short form. But you could say that it creates emotions that did not exist beforehand. It's mamash of yatser. I'm going to continue on. I know there are more... Agree, but it's not just that poetry describes it quicker, faster, and a little bit emotionally, but may actually be producing something that didn't exist before. A goddess of sorts, in this particular example. I don't know, anybody see Lord of the Rings? So the first Lord of the Rings, so there was the woman, the elf queen, what was her name? Was it Galadriel? When she takes the ring, right, when she imagines herself taking the ring, so she becomes something much more. This, as if when we combine the ring together, so all of a sudden we sort of fuse out, she becomes this sort of sea creature with her hair and the wind, the whole thing, and it creates emotional response which does not exist to say, oh, I could be really powerful. Let me explain how powerful I could be. She actually becomes and mutates into something brand new, kind of a metaphoric idea of this earth sea goddess. But I may be really, really off topic now, so let me continue on. Okay, we have so much text. Oh, yeah, this is really nice. This is really nice. There's no way we can do everything, and I apologize. I'll go on for just a few minutes. Oh, I'm sorry. I think I overestimated, as usual, how much I could do. The question is which part to get to. I'm going to skip this slide. I could just quickly tell you that it's a big machloket of Rashi and not Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra on Mishlei is not Ibn Ezra. It's actually Rav Yosef Kimchi, the father of David Kimchi. And Rashi doesn't even for a minute take the bait on the metaphor. He has each woman being a different type of, one is Avodah Zarah, one woman in one chapter, another one is Minut, or Nitziah towards Christianity or multiple gods, another one is Apikorsis. So he has each one separately divided, which is more or less how you were going. You were describing how each woman was a different kind of woman. He says each, because Rashi doesn't buy the metaphor for a second. He believes that some of the book of metaphors is clear that there's a meaning behind them. But Yosef Kimchi says, hey, she's a woman. God wanted to teach about women. So you can see there's this machloket even at that time. I'd like to read you Shir HaShirim, Rashi on Shir HaShirim and Ibn Ezra on Shir HaShirim. Yeah, I'll try. Rashi says, Echad diber Elohim shtayim zu shamati. God speaks one thing and two things do I hear from it. What Rashi is trying to say is that the Torah, as a divine book, is able to speak in stereo with one sound coming out of the right speakers, another sound coming out of the left speakers. And you know what I love about giving a class on metaphor? Is I count up all the metaphors I use to give the class, such as how God speaks out of right-hand speakers and left-hand speakers. And the nice thing, by the way, oh, there's so much to do here. The nice thing about, let's take the case of Shir HaShirim. Elef Magen Talui Alav Kol Shitei Agiburim. He's talking about his girl that he loves. And he says that there are 1,000 Magen, 1,000 shields chained around her, Kol Shitei Agiburim, all the great things of the Tzavareth Migdal HaDavid, her neck is like the Migdal of David, and is surrounded by, that just like it is surrounded by shields. That's a metaphor inside a metaphor inside a metaphor. He's describing the woman's neck. So the shields are not real shields. They're what? They're a beautiful necklace and how it really brings out the beauty of her neck. But of course, that is hidden inside a metaphor about Ir David. So Ir David is used to, as a metaphor for the woman. And then if we go one step further, we're sort of back in the metaphor for Ir David. So it's like a circular metaphor. You can go round and round forever. And it's really, really nice when a metaphor is used to describe something which is itself is a metaphor. Rashi essentially describes, Ein lecha mikra yotze bidei mashmao, va'af al pi. Now, here's what Rashi says. Important to know, by the way, Rashi very often does not use the word mashal. Rashi very often, when he speaks about mashal, uses the word dugma, or example. Sarich liyashev ha-dugma lofaneh v'al sidra. This is what somebody said here. This is what you said here. That is, even though this is a metaphor, shir hashirim, and even though we have to understand that they were describing something else, they spoke metaphorically. In order to understand the metaphor, I'm going to stop in just a minute, thank you. In order to understand the metaphor, you have to understand the literal story of what's going on. However, Rashi really still believes that the metaphor is the primary text. However, Ibn Ezra does not say that. He says, "Uliyoto b'drachav tamim," in order to be true to the book of Shir HaShirim, "Pirashtiv shalosh pe'anim." Pam Rishonai Gala Kol Minat Tzfuna. First, I'll just tell you what the words mean. Pam Shnia Yeh Mishpato Al Derech Pshuto. I'll tell it to you as it really is. Upam Shlishi Yeh Mfurash Tivot HaMidrash. And the key idea is Liot Bidrachav Tamim. In order to be true to the book, I have to give you both definitions. That would seem to indicate that Ibn Ezra believes that there's both sides, that there's both sides to it. There's obviously a lot more to do here. Just to end off quickly, if we went back to Yeshayahu, I can prove to you from other chapters that he's not talking about women at all. He's talking not about the people in Yerushalayim, but he's talking about Yerushalayim itself, just like we have in Eicha, with the woman who lies back and groans in Eicha, and she is a personification of Jerusalem. So too are these women of Jerusalem, a personification of Jerusalem. There's no time to prove it to you, but another day and another time, or look at the chapters yourself and you'll see that it's true. Have a nice day, and
thank you.
Take care.
I'm sorry to rush you like
that. That's okay. No.